I want you to imagine a healthcare system that performs absolutely perfectly on paper. I mean, every single metric is flashing green. It hits every budget target down to the cent. It maximizes patient volume, and it completely optimizes its organizational efficiency.
Right, a perfectly well-oiled machine.
Exactly. It's a flawless machine. But simultaneously, this exact same system is making both the patients and the doctors thoroughly, just fundamentally miserable.
Yeah.
And in some very real, measurable ways, it is actually making people sicker.
It is a terrifying paradox, isn't it? You have this machine succeeding wildly by its own internal logic, but the actual human beings trapped inside of it are failing.
And that paradox isn't science fiction. According to a brand new academic white paper published literally today, August 21st, 2026, it is the exact blueprint of modern Canadian healthcare and social
It
institutions.
really is.
So today we are taking a deep dive into this paper by Dr. Bechara Sali. It's titled Life Grounding CanMeds: Reorienting Medical Competence Within Canada's Unfinished Synthesis of Peace, Health, and the Civil Commons. And I'll tell you right now, it fundamentally shifts how you look at the systems governing our
It
lives.
really does. What Dr. Sahili's produced here is a critical integrative conceptual analysis, which I know that sounds
That
dense,
is a bit of a mouthful.
right? But what it essentially means is that he looks deeply at how our institutions, specifically in areas like healthcare and peace building, they start with these incredibly brilliant life-saving goals. But over time, they find themselves trapped in operational realities that actively work against those very same goals.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we really get into the weeds of how this happens, we need to set some context for you, the listener. We're going to be exploring the fundamental structures of healthcare, the actual definition of peace, and how society ultimately decides what human life is, worth.
And that requires a quick but important caveat, I think. This paper touches on some highly politically charged themes.
Sure.
We are going to be discussing colonial history, the regulation of commercial markets, economic redistribution, structural violence. And I want to be absolutely clear to everyone listening that our goal in this deep dive is not to take a political side on these issues.
Right, we're not endorsing a specific viewpoint.
Exactly. Our mission is simply to faithfully unpack, analyze, and help you understand the complex ideas that Dr. Sahli has presented in the source material, or is reporting on what's in the text.
Right, we are just looking at the map he drew. And to understand the core problem this paper diagnoses, we actually have to start by looking backward. We need to look at how Canada built its foundational ideals.
Yeah.
Because Dr. Sahli argues that there are six historical strands of Canadian identity that are conceptually brilliant but operationally unfinished.
Yes, he identifies this recurrent pattern across these six distinct institutions over the last several decades. And he uses a very specific phrase for it. He calls it a normative enlargement matched by an unresolved operational limit.
Okay, let's break that down because I feel like it's the engine driving this whole paper. When he says normative enlargement, he basically means that society decides to widen its scope of care, right?
Precisely. We look at a problem and say, actually, we shouldn't just care about treating the symptom. We should care about the whole system, the whole person. We enlarge our moral responsibility.
Right, that is the enlargement. But the operational limit is the reality check. It's the fact that the funding, the metrics, the daily bureaucratic rules, they never actually expand to match that grand new vision.
Exactly. The vision gets bigger, but the plumbing stays the same.
So let's trace this through the six strands because this is where the paper really brings the receipts. The first strand is peace building. And to understand this, we have to go all the way back to the Pearson era.
Lester B. Pearson, right? Winning the Nobel Peace Prize in 1957 for his role in the Suez Crisis. I mean, this is the bedrock of the modern Canadian global identity.
Right. And the normative enlargement here was the conceptual shift from negative peace to positive peace.
Right.
And negative peace is just, the absence of wars, just making sure the shooting stops. But positive peace is the realization that you haven't actually built peace until you build the conditions where people can thrive.
Yeah, where there is justice, equity, social stability, it is a beautiful ideal. But Dr. Sahli points out the severe operational limit here. Over decades, this ideal of positive peace gets heavily romanticized. It becomes this national mythology that we sell to ourselves. Like, for context, the paper notes that Canada committed over $40 million to UN peace operations in 2025 alone. But the romantic idea of the Canadian peacekeeper often masks underlying geopolitical interests and structural violence.
Oh, I think I see where he's going. We talk about positive peace, but we often still operate within global economic systems that normalize massive deprivation.
Exactly.
We might send peacekeepers to a region, but simultaneously participate in the economic extraction of that same region's resources, right? The operation is limited by our economic interests.
You nailed it. The vision expanded, but the operational reality stayed tethered to power dynamics. And that brings us to strand two, which hits much closer to home for most people. And that's Medicare.
Right. The grand jewel of the Canadian identity.
Yeah. It traces back to Saskatchewan in 1947 and 1962, eventually culminating in the 1984 Canada Health Act.
And the brilliant normative enlargement here is something we just kind of take for granted now, but it was revolutionary at the time, right? The idea that access to healthcare should be based entirely on human need, not on your purchasing power.
Right. If you are sick, society has your back, regardless of your bank account.
But look at the operational limit. It became what the paper calls a bounded basket. The political compromises required to pass Medicare meant the system got stuck entirely on covering hospital and physician services.
You drew a hard line around the clinic doors.
Which leaves huge, glaring gaps in care. When you think about what actually keeps a person healthy, Medicare doesn't cover dental care for most. It doesn't cover pharmaceuticals outside the hospital.
Right.
Doesn't cover long-term care, community care, psychotherapy.
The vision was universal health, but the operational reality contracted to universal access to a very specific, limited menu of acute services.
Yeah, like if you break your arm, the system is there. But if your teeth rot and cause a systemic infection, you're largely on your own until it gets bad enough to put you in the ER.
Exactly. And that realization actually birthed strand three, which is health promotion, because policymakers eventually realized the hospital just wasn't enough.
This stems from the famous 1974 Lalonde Report, right?
Yeah.
And later the 1986 Ottawa Charter.
Yes. Canada really helped pioneer this upstream thinking globally. The enlargement here was massive. The system officially recognized that health isn't just what happens in a doctor's office. Health is determined by your housing, by your education, your environment.
Social safety nets.
Exactly. Social determinants of health.
But the operational limit here is incredibly frustrating. Dr. Sangley points out that it is significantly easier and much cheaper for a government to fund individual lifestyle programs than it is to actually tackle structural redistribution.
Oh, absolutely. It's the difference between funding a public awareness campaign telling you to eat more vegetables.
Right, and go for a jog.
Yeah, versus challenging the commercial determinants of health, like the massive agricultural subsidies for ultra-processed foods, or the corporate monopolies keeping grocery prices artificially high in remote communities.
So if a person is working three minimum wage jobs and living in a food desert, telling them to just choose a healthier lifestyle is almost insulting.
It really is.
But functionally, that structurally constrained choice gets reframed by the system as just a personal failure. We enlarged the idea to include the environment, but operationally, we just started blaming people for the environment they are trapped in.
Which logically leads us to strand four, primary health care, or PHC, because if you want to fix those social determinants, you need a healthcare system embedded in the community.
And this goes back to the 1978 Alma-Eta Declaration, which called for health for all. The vision for primary healthcare was supposed to be a whole-of-society approach.
Right. It wasn't just supposed to be a doctor's office. It was meant to be an integrated hub, addressing daily living conditions, empowering communities, catching problems before they ever reached the hospital.
But the reality on the ground was reduced to first contact episodic appointments, right? The 15-minute med refill.
Yeah. And the paper brings some truly devastating stats to show this failure of integration.
Oh.
As of 2024, an estimated 5.7 million adults and 765,000 children in Canada lack a regular healthcare provider.
Millions of people with no point of access. So what happens to them?
Well, they wait until the problem is unignorable and then they go to the emergency room.
Wow.
Yeah, the Canadian Institute for Health Information estimates that about 15% of all emergency room visits are for conditions that could have been completely managed in primary care if the patient had access to it. It is massive systemic bottlenecking.
And that bottleneck forces us to look at the doctors themselves, which is strand five, CAN-MS. For listeners who aren't in the medical field, CAN-MS is an enormously influential framework developed in Canada that essentially defines what a physician is supposed to be.
Right. It dictates medical education.
Yeah.
And it expanded the definition of a doctor. It said, you know, you aren't just a medical expert diagnosing biology. To be a competent physician, you have to fulfill seven distinct roles.
Let me guess, they are.
You must also be a communicator, a collaborator, a leader, a health advocate, a scholar, and a professional.
The enlargement is beautiful. It explicitly states that medical expertise isn't enough if it's not socially enacted. You have to advocate for your patient. But what is the operational limit?
Assessment bias. Medical education and licensing still heavily favor observable, individual, technical acts. Think about it. I mean, it is very easy to grade a medical student on how well they stitch a wound or whether they know the correct dosage of a medication.
Sure. It's a multiple choice question or a practical exam.
Exactly. But how do you objectively grade a resident on how well they are advocating against systemic structural barriers in your community?
You can't.
Right. How do you test their ability to be a collaborator in a system that doesn't actually fund community collaboration? You can't. So the educational system defaults to testing what is easiest to see and measure. The grand vision shrinks back down to the biology exam.
And finally, that brings us to strand 6, which underpins all of this. Life value onto axiology, or LVOA. And this comes from the Canadian philosopher John McMurtry.
I want to spend a moment here because onto axiology sounds incredibly intimidating.
Yeah, it sounds like something from a grad school seminar I'd skip.
Right, but it's actually simple at its core. Ontology is the study of what exists, of being. Axiology is the study of what is valuable. So McMurtry is looking at the very nature of how we decide what has worth.
And the normative enlargement here is profound. McMurtry argues that we are currently measuring the success of our society entirely wrong. We use money, GDP, institutional size, and market price to determine value.
Exactly. Under that system, a forest only has value when you cut it down and sell the lumber.
Right. But McMurtry argues we should evaluate success purely by whether our systems enable universal life needs, like clean air, water, care, meaning, and physical health. The living forest producing oxygen has intrinsic life value.
But the operational limit is obvious to anyone living in the modern world. I mean, this philosophy remains entirely marginalized. Our mainstream policies are utterly obsessed with economic metrics. We still celebrate a rising GDP, even if the ecological and human cost to achieve it was catastrophic.
Okay, I have to jump in here and try to synthesize this, because when you list all 6 out like that, it sounds like an unbroken chain of massive failures. But wait a minute. Canada is famous globally for its healthcare system. The UN relies on its peacekeepers. CanMDS is used by medical schools all over the world. Aren't these massive success stories?
They are.
So when I hear you describe this gap between the grand vision and the depressing reality, it sounds to me like we built this magnificent, sprawling mansion. Like we put in a library for scholarship, a ballroom for peace, a massive kitchen for whole society health.
I love this analogy.
But then we only ever bothered to install plumbing in the front hallway. And now, millions of people are crammed into the hallway, waiting for a 15-minute appointment, while the rest of the beautiful house sits there, completely empty and rotting.
That is a phenomenal analogy.
Yeah.
But if we push that analogy further, what's fascinating here is that Dr. Zakaly explicitly says, this is not a failure of Canadian ideals. It is not that the idea of the mansion was wrong, or that the blueprint was fake.
So what is it?
He frames this as an institutional selection problem.
Okay, if the ideals are good, why can't we build the rest of the plumbing?
Because the systems we use to measure success, distribute funding, and allocate authority are simply too narrow for the massive goals we've set. Our institutions don't know how to select for or reward positive peace or whole society health. They only know how to select for measurable outputs.
Can you give me an example of how that selection actually happens?
Sure. Let's look at a hospital. A hospital can very easily measure how many beds it cleared today. It can measure how many surgeries were performed and how much those surgeries cost.
Right.
But it cannot easily measure the 20 heart attacks it prevented over the last decade because its doctors engaged in community health advocacy and improved local food security. Because the hospital cannot measure the prevented heart attacks, it cannot bill for them.
Wow.
Because it cannot bill for them, it cannot fund the advocacy. Therefore, the institution naturally selects for and optimizes clearing the beds.
I really want you, the listener, to pause and reflect on this dynamic in your own workplace for a second. Think about your company, your school, your nonprofit. How often does the stated mission on the poster in the lobby drastically differ from what actually gets you a promotion?
Oh, all the time.
Right. You might work for a company whose mission is revolutionizing customer happiness. But if your boss only gives you a bonus based on how fast you get people off the phone to keep wait times down, you are going to rush them off the phone.
Exactly.
The mission is happiness, but the metric is speed. The metric wins every single time.
That is the exact mechanism at play here, just scaled up to the level of national healthcare and global policy.
And if you leave this gap between purpose and practice open long enough, it doesn't just stall progress. The paper argues it actively morphs into a deeply toxic phenomenon. The gap becomes a trap. And that brings us to what the author calls institutional inversion.
Yes, this is a crucial concept. The purpose implementation gap is fundamentally caused by what Dr. Savley calls operational contraction. Because our grand visions are so broad and holistic, the actual operational responsibility contracts under the pressure of reality.
It shrinks down.
It shrinks down to what a bounded organization can legally control, what it can fund, what it can count, and what it can attribute directly to its own actions.
And the paper doesn't just state this as theory, right? It identifies 8 specific reinforcing mechanisms that drive this contraction. I think we need to walk through a hypothetical scenario to actually understand how these 8 mechanisms spring the trap. Let's invent a patient. Let's call him Marcus.
Okay, let's use Marcus.
So Marcus has severe chronic asthma. He keeps ending up in the emergency room because the apartment he rents has massive black mold problems and terrible ventilation. He represents the need for holistic health promotion.
Let's run Marcus through the 8 mechanisms of operational contraction. Number 1 is jurisdictional fragmentation. Right. Under the system, health delivery is a provincial responsibility. The province funds the hospital, the doctors, the steroids, and the oxygen Marcus needs when he arrives at the ER unable to breathe. They have total jurisdiction over his acute care. But housing, landlord regulation, environmental health standards, those are often municipal or federal jurisdictions. The hospital has zero legal authority to send an inspector to Marcus's apartment to force the landlord to remove the mold.
Right. So the problem, the root cause of his suffering, is structurally fragmented across different levels of government that don't share a budget or a mandate.
Exactly. And that leads to mechanism number 2, which is downstream financing.
Right. Because of the Canada Health Act, funding is fiercely protected for the hospital treating Marcus once he is already sick. That is mandatory funding. But upstream action, say, a municipal program to proactively inspect low-income housing and prevent asthma triggers before people get sick, that is discretionary funding.
Yes, it has to constantly beg for budget approvals every year. The money flows downstream to the crisis, not upstream to the prevention.
Mechanism 3 is professional and organizational silos.
Because everyone treating Marcus has their own budgets, their own professional languages, their own career ladders. The ER doctor, the public health official, the social worker, the housing advocate, they rarely share the same database, let alone the same strategy.
Right. So the doctor tells Marcus to avoid mold. The social worker tries to find him a new apartment, but there's no unified team with a single budget responsible for his overall well-being.
Exactly. And then we hit mechanism 4, which is the accessibility bias. And this one might be the most powerful of all.
Yeah, let's dig into this one.
It is the ultimate driver of the contraction. Institutions inherently prefer countable, attributable outputs. The hospital can easily log that they treated Marcus in 45 minutes and discharged him. That is an accessible win.
Right.
But building trust, preventing disease, changing housing policies, these things take years. And worse, they resist single-agent attribution. If Marcus doesn't get an asthma attack this year, who gets the credit?
The doctor. The housing advocate. The city council.
Exactly. Because the system can't put prevented asthma cleanly into a spreadsheet column, it simply stops trying to fund it.
Man, that's bleak. Mechanism 5 is normative avoidance.
Institutions desperately try to be politically neutral. The hospital administration doesn't want to get into a political fight with property developers over housing standards. So in attempting to remain neutral, they default to market price, or their own internal fiscal targets, as the ultimate measure of value.
They avoid making moral judgments about the mold and just focus on balancing the ER budget.
Exactly. Mechanism 6 is political economy.
This is the harsh reality, right? Upstream health action threatens powerful, concentrated commercial interests. If the healthcare system actually decided to tackle the root causes of disease, they would have to confront the ultra-processed food industry, the fossil fuel industry causing air pollution, and the real estate investment firms buying up affordable housing.
And that is a massive political fight that healthcare institutions are not designed to win.
Mechanism 7 is the colonial contradiction.
If we look at the broader historical context, the universalist national narratives in Canada, you know, the idea that Medicare is for everyone, have historically coexisted with the active dispossession and suppression of Indigenous health systems.
Right.
Trying to integrate Indigenous populations into a settler health system without offering actual jurisdictional self-determination doesn't heal the divide. It just reproduces the colonial problem under the guise of inclusion.
And finally, Mechanism 8 is narratives without mechanisms.
We love our slogans. Institutions will proudly declare a commitment to health promotion, social accountability, or reconciliation in their annual reports. But unless you attach actual hard financing, operational authority, and legally enforceable rights to those slogans, they remain empty words.
They are narratives without mechanisms to enact them. So poor Marcus goes through all 8 of these mechanisms. The hospital patches him up, sends him back to the moldy apartment, and logs a successful patient encounter. When you apply all 8 of those mechanisms over a period of decades, across millions of patients like Marcus, you get what Dr. Sanguli calls the great inversion.
This is the core tragedy at the heart of the paper. Under immense systemic pressure, institutions that were originally created to protect human life slowly start treating their own survival, their throughput, their fiscal targets, and their bureaucratic growth as the end goal.
The means literally become the ends.
Exactly. The patient ceases to be a human being and becomes throughput. A community ceases to be a living ecosystem of relationships and becomes merely a delivery site for services.
Wow.
The professional judgment of the doctor gets hollowed out. They're no longer an independent advocate, yeah, but just an instrument for organizational flow.
And the paper has this incredible chart, Table 2, that lists what it calls false completions. It highlights how our institutions essentially fake their own success by changing the definitions. Like, we tell ourselves we've achieved universality, but really we've just achieved equal entitlement to a highly restricted basket of acute services.
Mm.
We say we want prosperity, but we define that strictly as a rising GDP, even if our ecological capacity, like the very planet we live on, is actively collapsing to achieve that number. We say we want peace, but we actually just want pacification.
Right, and pacification is just managed disorder. We want marginalized people to be quiet and stop protesting, even if they're still facing massive structural deprivation. The institution considers it a success if the problem is quiet, not if the problem is solved.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because again, that accessibility bias is really the driver here, because trust, prevention, and deep healing take decades to show results. The system literally cannot see them. It is blind to them. The system optimizes for the spreadsheet, not the human being.
Right, to use another analogy, it's like a fire department that suddenly decides to measure its success and allocate its budget based strictly on how many gallons of water it sprays per month.
Oh, I see where this goes. At first, it sounds perfectly fine. They are putting out fires.
But very quickly, the incentives warp the behavior. The fire chief realizes they need to hit their monthly water spraying targets to guarantee their funding for next year. Suddenly, they are subtly incentivized to let fires burn just a little bit bigger before they show up, just so they can spray more water.
Oh, wow.
Or they start spraying water on houses that aren't even on fire just to get the numbers up. The means, spraying water, has completely cannibalized the end goal, which was supposed to be public safety and keeping houses intact.
If you are listening to this, I guarantee you have experienced this inversion in your own life. Think about a time you had to deal with a massive healthcare institution, or a health insurance company, or even a large university bureaucracy. You likely felt that distinct cold moment where you realized the person across the desk wasn't looking at you as a complex human being with a unique problem. They were looking at you as a case, a data point, a liability, or a box to check. You were experiencing an institution that was entirely optimized for throughput. And the terrifying part is, it wasn't their fault personally. The person across the desk might be deeply empathetic. It was the great inversion operating through them.
That is the tragedy. Good people forced to enact structural violence because of the rules of the game.
So if our institutions are currently guided by this massive, terrifying inversion, if the GPS is just driving us in circles to rack up mileage while the passengers get sicker, how on earth do we reprogram it? How do we find our way back to actually caring for people and protecting life? We clearly need a new language. We need a new compass.
We do. And that is exactly what the second half of the paper provides. Dr. Zahirli argues we need a fundamentally new grammar for decision making. And he proposes a framework he calls life coherence. This framework is explicitly built to cure the inversion. To understand it, we need to grasp 2 foundational concepts that he establishes, life ground and life capacity.
Let's define those carefully because they sound a bit philosophical and abstract, but they are incredibly grounded in physical reality.
They are entirely physical. Life's ground represents the absolute universal material and ecological conditions that are required for any form of life to exist and continue. This isn't abstract poetry. We're talking about breathable air, potable water, nourishing food, safe shelter, basic physical care, and an intact ecosystem.
Right.
Without the life ground, everything else, the economy, politics, art, instantly stops. It is the prerequisite for existence.
Okay, so the life ground is the soil, and life capacity is what grows out of that soil. It's what a living being can actually do once those baseline needs are met. It's the capacity to sense the world, to move, to think, to relate to others, to feel emotion, to participate in society.
Exactly. A person who is starving and freezing, whose life ground is deprived, has a very restricted life capacity. All their energy goes to sheer survival.
Mm.
A healthy society uses what the author calls its civil commons to protect the life ground.
What falls under the civil commons?
It's any cooperative social construct that provides life goods based on human need, not market power. Medicare is a civil commons. Public libraries are a civil commons. Safe municipal water systems, labor protections, public parks, these are all structures we built together to guarantee the life ground so that individuals can maximize their life capacity.
So to build this life coherence framework, Dr. Saheli pulls off a bit of an intellectual heist. He merges three distinct, massive philosophical heavyweights to create this new grammar. He takes epistemology, diagnosis, and value, and weaves them together. Let's unpack these three thinkers, starting with the biological epistemology of Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela. What on earth do they bring to the table for a hospital administrator?
Maturana and Varela are fascinating. They argued that the categories we use in our professions, words like efficiency, value, disease, or success, are not objective, neutral realities handed down by the universe. They are created by observers. They're social practices that we enact.
Meaning we made them up.
Yes. If a hospital defines success as beds cleared, that is an arbitrary reality they have chosen to enact. It is not a law of physics. Acknowledging this constructivist view is incredibly liberating because it forces us to realize that if the rules are currently hurting people, we can change the rules because we invented them in the first place.
Second, he brings in the sociologist Johann Gultum for the diagnosis portion.
Gultum is vital here. He forces us to look beyond direct physical violence. We all know what direct violence is, a punch to the face, a gunshot. But Gultum insists we must diagnose structural and cultural violence.
How does that apply to healthcare?
It's the difference between someone being denied a home because a person physically blocked the door and threatened them versus a person being denied a home because a complex financial structure systematically redlined their neighborhood and priced them out.
Right.
The result is the same. Deprivation of shelter. But the structural violence is invisible. It's built into the spreadsheet. Gultum gives us the language to say this policy is violent.
And third, he brings back John McMurtry for value. As we discussed earlier, McMurtry argues that we must evaluate the success of any system purely by whether it enables life capacity without destroying the life ground, period, not by its profit margin.
Out of this synthesis of those three thinkers, Dr. Saheli creates the life coherence test. It's a seven-field diagnostic test. The idea is that any policymaker, hospital administrator, or government official should run every major decision through these seven fields before enacting it.
Let's run through them quickly. Field one, what life need is actually at stake here? Field two, what violence or harm is being hidden or normalized by this policy? Field three, what is the distribution of power and benefits? Who wins and who loses?
Right.
Field four, what are the effects on the life ground? Are we destroying the environment to build a hospital? Field five, what is the viability? Meaning, what future options are we permanently closing off by doing this? Field six, are rights and authority respected, particularly indigenous rights? And finally, field seven, what evidence would make us change our minds if this goes wrong?
I want to hone in on the specific definition of life coherence here, because it is crucial that listeners understand what we are aiming for. Life coherence is not just stability. It's not uniformity, and it is certainly not coercion. The paper makes a brilliant point. Highly exploitative, structurally violent systems can be incredibly stable and internally consistent.
Right. A dictatorship can be very stable for decades.
Exactly. An extraction-based economy that pollutes the local river while maximizing corporate profit can run very smoothly and consistently for generations. That is stable, but it is not life coherent. Coherence in this framework means preserving the material conditions of wider life, the air, the water, the human dignity, while keeping the rules of the system open to the people who are actually affected by those rules. It means you cannot have a closed loop where the powerful elites decide what's working based only on their own internal metrics.
Okay, I have to jump in with a major, massive pushback here, because I can hear the cynics in the audience, and frankly, I share some of the skepticism. If we define the ultimate success of our institutions as enabling life and maximizing life capacity, doesn't that just become an impossible utopian standard? Let's live in the real world for a second.
Okay.
Resources are finite. Beds in an intensive care unit are finite. Taxpayer dollars are finite. How does a triage doctor or a provincial health minister weigh the life capacity of one group against the life capacity of another group? Aren't we just swapping an economic spreadsheet for an impossible moral spreadsheet that will paralyze decision making?
It's a fantastic, necessary pushback, and the paper anticipates it completely. The author explicitly establishes what he calls guardrails around this concept. Dr. Saley notes very clearly that this framework is not about the authoritarian optimization of life.
Okay.
He fully acknowledges that physiological limits, geological constraints, and conflicting human needs are painfully real.
Mm.
You cannot save everyone. You cannot fund everything.
So how does the seven-field test actually help in a resource crisis?
The goal of life coherence isn't to magically eliminate conflict or pretend that tragic trade-offs don't exist. The goal is to make those trade-offs publicly visible and democratically revisable. Right now, when a hospital administration quietly cuts a community outreach program to save money, the trade-off is hidden behind a proxy metric, like budget efficiency.
The public doesn't see the lives that will be shortened by that cut. They just see a green arrow on a quarterly financial report.
The violence is hidden in the accounting.
Yes.
The life coherence test forces the system to admit what it is doing out loud. It forces the administrator to say, we are choosing to contract the life capacity of this specific community in order to preserve the fiscal viability of this hospital wing. By making the violence visible, it becomes open to democratic contestation and correction. Maybe the public decides the trade-off is unacceptable and demands higher taxes. Maybe they accept it. But it stops the institution from hiding behind the math.
That is incredibly powerful. It forces moral accountability back into the boardroom. But as much as I love philosophical frameworks, they are great when you're writing an academic white paper in an office. How does this actually touch down in the real world? How does this enter the messy, exhausted clinical reality of a doctor's office on a Tuesday morning? Well, this brings us to a massive, incredibly timely shift that is happening in Canadian medicine right now in the year 2026.
We are talking about CanMeds 2026.
Right. We touched on this earlier, but for those who aren't medical educators, CanMeds is an enormously influential framework that literally defines what a physician is supposed to be. And the paper notes that a brand new, totally overhauled revision CanMeds 2026 was just approved on July 15, 2026, and is set for a massive rollout in October.
Dr. Sakelli views this exact moment, this rollout of CanMeds 2026, as a strategic hinge. It is the perfect mechanism to take all of this deep, abstract clinical truth we've been discussing and connect it directly to daily public responsibility.
But he makes a very crucial distinction here. He is not saying we should add an eighth role to CanMeds. He doesn't want to create a new separate category called Life Ground Protector that medical students have to memorize and test for.
Absolutely not, because that would just create another silo. It would become another box to check on an exam, subject to the exact same accessibility bias we discussed. Instead, the Life Ground lens asks what the original seven CanMed roles are actually for. It provides the missing orienting compass for all of them.
The paper maps out how applying this lens changes the seven roles beautifully in Table 3. I want to deep dive into this because this is where the rubber meets the road for doctors. First is the medical expert role. This is the core of being a physician.
Right. With the Life Ground lens, you don't lose the biology. You still need to know how to prescribe medication. But you integrate the ecological and structural constraints on recovery into your expertise. Let's go back to our hypothetical patient, Marcus. The medical expert doesn't just diagnose the asthma. They diagnose the black mold in the apartment as the primary material constraint on Marcus's recovery. The mold is treated as a medical fact, not just a social footnote.
Exactly. Then you have the communicator role. Traditionally, this just means talking clearly to the patient, breaking down complex jargon, obtaining consent. But through the Life Ground lens, the communicator specifically checks whose voice is missing from the room. They look for power imbalances. They ensure culturally safe choice, not just legal medical consent.
The collaborator role shifts dramatically, too. It moves from just talking to other doctors or nurses within the hospital walls to actively linking the clinical team with community and ecological capacities. You are collaborating with the social worker, the housing advocate, the local food bank. You are building a web of life support around the patient.
Then there is the leader role, and this is where the great inversion usually happens. Leadership in healthcare often devolves into managing throughput, you know, optimizing the schedule, getting patients in and out faster, staying under budget.
The LifeGround lens forces the leader to act as a steward. They must steward resources based on life need, equity, and future options. The leader tests whether so-called efficiencies are actually just contracting access and exhausting the workforce. They lead for life capacity, not for the spreadsheet.
The health advocate role is maybe the most vital transformation here. Without this lens, advocacy shrinks to what the paper calls brokerage.
Brokerage is just navigation. It's when a doctor refers a patient to a food pantry and says, "I advocated for them." The doctor helped the individual, but the structural barrier hasn't changed. The food pantry is still overwhelmed, and the patient is still in poverty.
The LifeGround lens demands that the advocate moves from isolated referrals to actually escalating recurring structural barriers. If 10 patients come in with severe frostbite from the exact same underfunded homeless shelter, the health advocate escalates the systemic failure of the shelter to policymakers. They don't just hand out 10 pairs of gloves and call it a day.
Right. The scholar role shifts as well. It demands that we separate actual causation from mere statistical analogy. And critically, it insists that affected communities are included in the research design itself. We have to respect indigenous data sovereignty, and we must publish negative findings if a policy fails, rather than hiding them to save face.
And finally, the professional role. It elevates from merely following the code of conduct or avoiding malpractice suits to viewing the social contract as a covenant with the LifeGround and future generations. The professional actively names unsafe institutional norms and refuses to blame the patient for structural failures.
It's a huge shift.
So what does this all mean? If I have to synthesize this, it's like CAN-MDES is an incredibly detailed manual that teaches you how to drive a highly complex, powerful vehicle. It teaches you how to steer, how to brake, how to read the dials. Those are the 7 roles. But the LifeGround lens is the GPS. It's the navigation system telling you that you are actually driving toward the correct destination, human flourishing, rather than just driving very, very skillfully off a cliff.
I love that. And if we connect this to the bigger picture of medical education, it highlights a massive problem that educators call the hidden curriculum.
What is the hidden curriculum?
Well, we can teach medical students all day long about equity and stewardship and the social determinants of health in a pristine classroom. We can give them the CAN-MES GPS, but if we then force them to do their residency in a hospital system that only rewards speed, silence, and self-sacrifice, the students learn very quickly that the classroom stuff was a lie.
Right.
The hidden curriculum teaches them that compliance with the machine is all that actually matters.
Yes. The system selects for compliance, not advocacy. If a resident spends an extra 20 minutes doing health advocacy for a patient's housing, they're going to get reprimanded for backing up the waiting room.
Exactly. Teaching LifeGround values in an institution that remains fundamentally life-disabling will not produce revolutionary doctors. It will only produce profound moral contradiction and moral distress.
Right.
The doctors will burn out because their core identity, their desire to heal, is constantly at war with their operational reality.
Which brings us perfectly to the next major point of the paper. Retraining doctors is absolutely useless if the hospitals and clinics they work for remain trapped in the Great Inversion. You can't just change the minds of the individuals, you have to change the rules of the institution.
Yes.
The paper doesn't just leave us with a philosophical critique of the hidden curriculum. It proposes a very concrete 5-point operational program to overhaul the physical system. And it argues that the year 2026 is the exact fleeting moment we have to do it.
Why 2026? It's not just because CAN-HEM is launching. Dr. Singhirali points out that we are currently sitting at a terrifying convergence of systemic crises. These crises are making the old way of doing things mathematically and morally impossible to maintain.
He lists them out, and they are daunting. We have an unprecedented primary care access crisis. We have planetary ecological disruption and climate emergencies directly impacting public health. We have toxic drug deaths ravaging communities at scale. We have the sudden rapid integration of AI and digital platforms into health systems, which is reshaping data overnight. And critically, we have the unavoidable reality of the colonial contradiction.
I want to highlight this specific statistic the paper uses to illustrate that colonial contradiction because it is brutal and undeniable. In 2024, only 54.3% of Inuit adults reported having a regular health provider. That is compared to 85.7% of non-Indigenous adults.
That's horrifying, an absolute indictment of the universal system. A 30-point gap is not a rounding error, it is a structural failure.
It is, and the author argues that trying to integrate Indigenous populations into the settler health system without granting them actual self-determination and jurisdictional authority just reproduces colonialism. It doesn't fix the problem, it rebrands it.
Mm-hmm.
We are at a breaking point on all these fronts. Incremental reform is no longer viable.
So how do we rebuild the ship while we are sailing it? Dr. Siley offers a 5-point operational program. Step one, establish a Canadian Life Ground Collaborative.
This isn't about creating another centralized federal bureaucracy. It's about convening Indigenous governments, provincial health authorities, and civil society at the same table to develop shared methods for measuring how policies actually impact life. It's about agreeing on the grammar before writing the rules.
Step two is massive. Rebuild primary health care as a community civil commons. The paper argues we have to completely stop funding clinics based on the volume of transactions they process, the fee-for-service model that drives the 15-minute appointment.
Instead, we need to fund interdisciplinary teams, nurses, pharmacists, social workers, Indigenous healers, and doctors based on their responsibility for a population. A capitation model, but broader. And crucially, this must include actual community governance. The people living in the neighborhood need a say in how the resources are allocated to address their specific local life ground needs.
Step three is institutionalizing health peace and life impact assessments.
This is applying that 7-field test we talked about earlier to all major domestic and foreign policies. If we are funding safe housing or overdose prevention sites, we need to formally recognize that as domestic peace building. It's creating the infrastructure of positive peace. And conversely, if a policy destroys the local environment, the health impact must be accounted for in the budget.
Step four is creating a life coherence dashboard and a public learning cycle. This is a mechanism to track essential life goods, equity, and ecological integrity across the system.
Okay, hold on. Wait. I am struggling with this one, and I think our listeners will too. Didn't we just spend the entire first half of this deep dive complaining bitterly about the accessibility bias?
I did.
About how metrics and dashboards and quarterly reports are the exact tools that caused the great inversion in the first place? How optimizing for a dashboard strips away the human element? And now the author's big systemic solution is to build a life coherence dashboard. Isn't that just a shiny new spreadsheet for institutions to optimize blindly? I feel like we're walking right back into the trap. This raises an important question, and it's the exact trap the author is trying to avoid. Dr. Sashili places very specific, rigid guardrails on this dashboard concept to prevent it from becoming a weapon of the inversion. He insists that this dashboard is absolutely not meant to compress human life into a single score. It's not a technocratic command tool where a hospital administrator just tries to get the life score up to 100 to get a bonus.
So if it's not for optimization, how is it different from the metrics we have now?
It is designed strictly for deliberative feedback. Its primary function is to act as an early warning system for displaced harms. When a policy is enacted, the dashboard tracks not just the intended outcome, but the margins. It looks for workforce exhaustion, ecological drain, widening equity gaps. Furthermore, it forces decision makers to publicly publish their anticipated harms and their areas of uncertainty before they act.
Okay, so it forces humility.
Yes. And most importantly, the dashboard is tied to mandatory review dates. It forces the system to stop, look at the holistic consequences, and say, did this actually work for human beings, or did it just look good on paper? And if it failed, how do we dismantle it? It's an instrument for course correction, not an instrument for punishment or reward.
It's basically institutionalizing the act of saying, let's check our blind spots. I can see how that's different from a purely financial ledger. And that brings us to the final point of the 5-point plan. Step five, protect time, authority, and moral agency.
This is perhaps the most vital point for the frontline workers listening today. The paper demands that clinicians be given protected time and the psychological safety to escalate recurring harms without fear of being punished by management.
I want to speak directly to you, the listener, again. Think about the concept of moral distress. If you work in healthcare or social work or education, or frankly, any large corporate environment, you know this feeling deep in your bones. The system tells you that your job is to care for people, but gives you exactly 5 minutes to do it. You feel exhausted. You feel burned out. What this paper is telling you is that your burnout is not an individual wellness problem.
No, it is not.
It is not because you didn't do enough yoga or because you forgot to download the right meditation app or because you aren't resilient enough. Your moral distress is a systemic warning sign. It is the friction of your professional human commitments violently colliding with institutional rules that are optimized for throughput. It is the sound of your humanity grinding against the machine.
That is exactly it. When you ask a doctor to be a health advocate under CanMeds, but give them zero time in their schedule, zero authority over social resources, and zero protection from hospital administrators who just want faster turnaround times, you aren't empowering them. You are giving them an unfunded moral mandate. You are telling them to fix the world with their bare hands. And that just breaks people. Step 5 says we must give them the structural authority to match the moral mandate.
So we have this sweeping philosophy and we have this 5-point operational plan. But the paper doesn't just demand we roll this out blindly across the country tomorrow and hope for the best. The author insists that this entire framework must be testable. It has to be subject to what he calls reflexive public learning.
Drawing on systems thinkers like Danella Meadows and Eleanor Ostrom, Dr. Saheli proposes 4 specific falsifiable pilots to test this framework in the real world. This is where the theory hits reality.
Let's look at table 4. The first pilot is testing the LifeGround CanMeds integration. They want to measure if teaching this lens actually improves clinical reasoning, or if it just inadvertently increases that moral distress we just talked about by making students more aware of problems they can't fix.
The second pilot tests the community primary healthcare model. Does funding interdisciplinary teams based on population responsibility actually improve a patient's attachment to a doctor? Does it actually reduce avoidable emergency room visits? Or does it just increase administrative burden and red tape?
The third pilot tests the life impact assessments on policy. Do these 7 field assessments actually change the design of policies to prevent harm, or do they just become another layer of bureaucratic paperwork that delays action?
And the fourth pilot tests that Life Coherence dashboard we debated earlier. Does multi-domain feedback help identify trade-offs earlier, or does it just lead to indicator overload, data fatigue, and people gaming the system? What is absolutely critical here is that Dr. Saheli explicitly demands that null or negative findings from these pilots must be published.
If the framework fails, we have to loudly admit it failed.
Exactly. By insisting on falsifiability, the author proves that this is a scientific endeavor. It is a corrigible public learning process. It is not a totalizing ideology that must be defended at all costs, regardless of the human toll.
I have to say, I appreciate how incredibly thorough this paper is in trying to protect its own good intentions from being weaponized. It's like the author knows that the great inversion is always lurking in the shadows, ready to turn any good idea into a toxic metric. To that end, the paper concludes with a set of ethical guardrails. These are strict boundaries designed to prevent the LifeGround lens from becoming just another coercive tool of the state.
There are 4 vital guardrails here. First, no patient blame. The framework recognizes human agency, yes, but it acknowledges that structural exposure, historical trauma, and material limits are violently real. We do not blame the patient for the failures of the system that surrounds them.
Second, no appropriation of indigenous knowledge. The paper states clearly that recognizing relational resonance does not erase indigenous sovereignty. Integration must mean restitution, resource sharing, and jurisdictional respect. It cannot just mean extracting indigenous concepts to make settler frameworks look more holistic on a brochure.
Third, no cross-domain overreach. Just because a philosophical analogy sounds good doesn't mean it replaces rigorous clinical evidence. The LifeGround lens contextualizes biology. It does not replace it.
And fourth, which we touched on earlier, no unfunded moral mandates. We cannot hold frontline workers accountable for fixing structural violence without giving them the actual authority, the time, and the resources to do so.
It is a profound, beautifully structured argument. It takes us from the loftiest heights of global peace building all the way down to the exhausted reality of a 15-minute clinical appointment and draws a straight line connecting them.
We've been on quite a journey today. Let's do a quick synthesis of the map we just explored. We started by looking at 6 magnificent Canadian ideals like positive peace, Medicare, and health promotion, and realized they all suffered from an operational limit. The plumbing didn't match the mansion.
Right.
We discovered how that gap leads to operational contraction, driven by 8 mechanisms, which ultimately creates the institutional inversion, where the survival of the machine becomes more important than the lives of the people it was built to serve.
We then explored the LifeGround lens and the 7-field life coherence test as a new grammar to cure that inversion, making the hidden trade-offs and structural violence visible to the public.
We looked at the rollout of CanMinDes 2026 as the strategic hinge to put this philosophy into the minds of future doctors, changing them from just medical mechanics into stewards of life capacity. And finally, we unpacked a concrete 5-point operational plan backed by testable pilots and strict ethical guardrails to actually rebuild primary care and institutional feedback.
It is a masterclass in connecting high-level systemic diagnosis with grounded, implementable reality.
As we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought. It builds on something briefly mentioned in the paper regarding the rapid deployment of artificial intelligence and digital systems. The entire core of Dr. Saheeli's warning is about institutions taking our data and optimizing it for their own survival, ignoring the unmeasurable human elements.
It is the accessibility bias on steroids. AI is the ultimate engine for optimization.
Exactly. So as we feed all of our personal health data, our clinical encounters, and our systemic metrics into generative AI and massive digital platforms over the next few years, what are we actually building? Are we using AI to create the ultimate civil commons of knowledge, a system capable of seeing the whole life ground of a patient instantly and identifying structural violence? Or because these massive AI models are currently being trained on our current structurally violent inverted systems, are we just teaching AI to hyper-optimize the great inversion? Are we permanently algorithmically coding the accessibility bias into the future of human health? Are we creating a machine that is literally mathematically incapable of seeing the value of a human life beyond a spreadsheet?
That is the existential question of the next decade of healthcare. If we don't fix the grammar of our institutions now, as Dr. Saheeli outlines, we are going to teach our machines the exact wrong language. And once the AI learns that language, it might be impossible to unteach it.
It brings us right back to where we started. The danger of building a perfectly performing machine that doesn't actually know what a human being is. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. I highly encourage you to look at the structures, the rules, and the metrics in your own life, your own workplace, and your own community through this new life ground lens. Trace the mechanisms. Look for the inversion. You might be surprised and unsettled by what you see. Take care, everyone.